good morning. So the purpose of this talk is to establish the link between those two pictures, which may look very different at first sight. So on the left is a numerical simulation of a detonation by Frank Timmes. So such detonations may happen in type 1A supernovae. And this is on a very small scale. This is the combustion of carbon, and this is a centimeter scale instability. And on the right is a numerical simulation of the inner region of a core collapse supernovae, where you have a non-spherical, an asymmetric instability, which has some outstanding consequences in the case of core collapse supernovae, and this is a scale of a few hundred kilometers. And both instabilities seems to be related to the same physical mechanism. I'm not sure whether the consequences of this instability are as interesting in the case of type 1As as they are in the case of core collapse, but I think it is worth better understanding them, even if their consequences are modest. So I will first describe the basics of unstable detonations, and then the formalism used for description of such instabilities. So many of you heard a talk by Frank Timmes a few weeks ago about stationary detonations. So he didn't say much about their unstable character. So a stationary detonation is basically a shock wave. So here is the Mach number as a function of position. It's basically a shock wave which is pushed by some energy release due to some chemical reactions. So in the case of type 1A, it will be some nuclear burning, localized at some distance lagging behind the shock wave. So you have here a supersonic flow which becomes subsonic, and the energy release can be sufficient to have this regime self-sustained without the need for a piston. So this is called the Chapman-Jouguet regime, in which we have this particularity that the Mach number after the detonation reaches one. So it's this flow behind the shockwave is transonic, and it's very particular. And simply based on the amount of energy released behind the shockwave, you can compute the theoretical velocity of this detonation. So the velocity measured in the frame of the laboratory in units of the C0, which is the sound speed in the laboratory.
Infinite,
yeah. Okay. And Q is the energy release, and you have a velocity which scales like a square velocity which scales like Q, which makes sense. If Q is large, it goes faster. And then you have a second type of detonations, which are called overdriven detonations, in which the energy release is not responsible directly for this shock wave, but you have a piston which pushes and creates this shock wave, and some energy is released. So we define the overdrive parameter F as this, from the ratio of sound speed of velocity of this detonation, because by pushing a detonation you have it faster, you have it reaching faster velocities than the Chapman-Jouguet velocity. So this ratio of velocities defines the overdrive parameter. So basically, to describe a stationary detonation, there are three important parameters. One is the heat release, this value Q. One is this overdrive factor, depending on whether you use a piston or not. And another important parameter is used to describe the kinetics of the chemistry behind the shock, and is called the activation energy, which I write here, which describes the reaction, how sensitive the reaction rate is with respect to temperature. So the fact that the chemistry the heat release lags behind the shock is due to the fact that it takes some time for the reaction rate to liberate this, to release this energy, and this is due to this activation energy E, which is a constant. So you have this very strong here dependence on temperature in this toy model, which is on a one-step Arrhenius kinetics. So apart from this this part, apart from this reaction rate, which contains some physics and which could be much more complicated, especially in the case of type 1As, the rest of the equations are very simple in this simplest description of detonation. So you have a Euler equation and a continuity equation and a heat release which changes the entropy. So this stationary flow which I showed, this stationary detonation does not exist as a stationary detonation most of the time, and it is unstable. And it's been unstable for a long time. It's been known that it's unstable from experiments, from numerical simulations, and from linear stability analysis. And I should say that all these three approaches of detonation agree more or less together that it is unstable due to some linear instability. And when people compute the growth rate based on the simple model I've just described before, they find growth rates and they find typical sizes for the instability which agree with the experiments and numerical simulations. So basically in 2D the instability looks like this. You have the detonation propagating to the right, viewed here in pressure, temperature, vorticity and mass fraction of the reactant, and you have this cellular pattern which appears. Instead of having a nice 1D flow, you have a cellular pattern like that, and you have in black, you have an idea of the size of the induction length, which I have introduced before as the distance between the shock and this region of heat release, and you can see that this induction length is typically smaller than the size of this pattern by a factor which is 3 here, or which could be even more. And you can, by a linear analysis, you can compute the growth rate as a function of the wave number, the transverse wave number, and obtain, for example, that it is most unstable for a certain wavelength lambda, which agrees with the numerical simulations and experiments in general for simple cases. So the problem is that once you do a linear stability analysis, you don't necessarily understand what's happening. You have proven that there is some underlying instability mechanism, a linear one, but doesn't mean that you understand what's happening. And there has been many many papers on this subject since the pioneering work of Erpenbeck in 62. Up to the recent work of Clavin and his collaborators and Short and Stewart, trying to get a physical handle on this, or a mathematical handle on this instability. A mathematical handle was obtained by these people using a very mathematical approach based on asymptotic developments in very specific range of parameters, like for a very large activation energy or very large overdrive. But to my point of view, these studies, or if you try to read those papers, maybe you will agree that they don't talk to you much from the physical point of view. So in the case of type 1As, which might be more interesting for you, the problem is more complicated than the simple kinetics of the Arrhenius law. Since you have all this network of nuclear reactions, which introduce, instead of having a very well-defined energy release, you have an energy release which happens on many different timescales due to this network of reactions. So basically, the first approach was limited to one reaction, and now we have plenty, and this is only a simplification, as you know, of what happens in reality. And more or less, people like Gamezzo described the effect of of detonation in the case of type 1As, and pointed out the existence of three different time scales which are responsible for three different cellular sizes for the detonation. So on the centimeter time scale, on the centimeter length scale, you are dominated by the conversion of carbon. On the kilometer length scale, you are dominated by the conversion of oxygen and the group of oxygen, and so on for silicon. And of course, once you reach these silicon burning, you reach length scale which are comparable to the size of the yes. Okay.
I was sending this. I don't recall exactly what Nadine did. So how was the overdrive factor determined?
He measured
the simulation temperature in this lower panel.
He measured the overdrive. There is this information is more or less Chapman-Jouguet. There are a few cases.
So it's Chapman-Jouguet.
Yes.
In Chapman-Jouguet, this effect should be very, very small, right? This instability.
Oh no! Oh no! It's very strong. It's strongest for Chapman-Jouguet detonation.
Yeah.
And of course, I should say that to do these simulations, he didn't do this. These are really three different simulations. He did not manage to resolve both the instability of carbon and this one. So in this one, it does not resolve the combustion of the two others. So you should think of this superposition of these three phenomena.
I'm just confused. The scale depends on temperature. Like burning scale.
Yes.
So the case of silicon burn usually very, very high temperature and short time scale. So, so the scale should be very, very small, short. Instead of the carbon is carbon burning occur at low temperature, so the scale should be quite long.
In his description, the main parameter is density. And he's got this description as a function of density. You have the scale, the induction length associated to carbon, oxygen, and silicon.
But it depends on temperature.
So it's a pity Craig Wheeler is not here because he's one of the authors of this paper. I don't know.
Maybe he'll show up.
Yes, I said. Takes place initially carbon mining, which is low.
And that was my question actually. If the Mach number is sufficiently high, then of course the temperature will rise according to, and then the carbon burning time would be short. But if the Chapman-Jouquet, that would be just sound speed, and not Mach number one, and then the shock healing shouldn't be so substantial.
No, but when we say Mach number one, it's the post-shock after the reaction, okay. But before the reaction, the Mach number can be very big.
My question, how is in this simulation then the true Mach number determined?
Yeah.
Exactly now the question comes.
Yeah. I think it's in the range 5 to 8. It's always in this.
So where does this number come from?
From the heat release. So if you take the heat release, from the formula I showed at the beginning, you take the heat release and depending on the sound speed in the medium in which the detonation is going to propagate, you immediately obtain the Mach number of the Chapman-Jouguet detonation. This was the Mach number is directly related to the heat release.
So if this number is big, then Ken's question is answered.
Ah, good.
then the heat and the temperature in this mix in the carbon oxygen goes up to height that the time scale for carbon burning is short. It's really then explosive carbon burning.
I'm sorry, I cannot. But yes, this is an important point anyway, that there is two Mach number. One is before the detonation, and this can be high, given by this formula. And after the detonation, it's either one if it's Chapman-Jouguet, or slightly smaller if it's overdriven. So anyway, potentially this in 99 at least, this instability looked as an important physical process for type 1As, because it is responsible for some inhomogeneities in the burning. So here it is responsible for inhomogeneities in concentrations on these three scales: the scale of carbon centimeter scale, the scale of oxygen, the scale of silicon. Here he showed some concentration plots on these three different scales, and here he showed the concentration history, the fluctuation of the concentration compared to a 1D model, and he obtained significant inhomogeneities, which showed that if one were to use a criterion for the quenching of the detonation once the induction length, for example, is comparable to the size of the gradient in the white dwarf or to the size of the white dwarf itself, then the detonation should stop. And the fact that there is this instability changes this reaction length by 30% or 60% factors. So this looked as a phenomenon that should be taken into account to describe the detonations in a type 1A. But the thing is, after 1999 and the work of Frank Timmes in 2000, there was very little work on this topic. And as far as I understand, the deflagration, which happens before the detonation, which is supposedly happens before the detonation, is responsible for so many inhomogeneities that this type of academic model where a detonation propagates in a uniform medium maybe is not so relevant, because there are already inhomogeneities and 30% inhomogeneities are already present in the... So maybe, I don't know, I'm looking forward to hearing your opinion, but it seems that this, although it's often cited, there has been no more work on this topic after this paper. So my approach is rather to try to understand better why these instabilities happen, and I said I would show the link with this advective acoustic cycle happening in core collapse supernovae. So the idea of some feedback between the region of heat release and the shock is not new. And apparently, Shelkin thought of some feedback process as early as 1959. And in the subsequent literature, you find this idea of feedback quite frequently. Nevertheless, this idea has never been formalized and used in a quantitative manner. And my work on detonations, and before that on Bondi Hoyle, the instability of Bondi Hoyle accretion, has led me to develop a formalism which has proved useful to estimate and understand such instabilities. So I'm now going to describe what's happening in general for these advective acoustic instabilities, which are very old. Because they have been known since the work of Shano and Powell in 65 to explain the whistling kettle, all these instabilities are based on the advection of perturbation in a flow and some acoustic feedback. So in the case of the whistling kettle, you have the hot gas which goes through the first ring. So there are two rings in the kettle, and there is a shear layer. There is no shock in this case, but there is a shear layer which produces vortices, and these vortices are carried by the flow and go out through the second ring. By going out through the second ring, they produce some acoustic feedback, because the second ring is creates some gradients in the flow. The flow is no longer homogeneous, and this acoustic feedback triggers the formation of these vortices at a certain frequency, which is responsible for the frequency of the sound we...
So you hear the vortices?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you adjust you hear the length of this thing, you get different sounds, is that...?
By the length, yes, by varying the length, you get different sounds.
It's a musical length.
And a similar... So you clearly have advection and acoustic feedback. And you have a similar process in a ramjet compressor where you have a shock plus some chemistry which describes the combustion, and then this flow is accelerated through a nozzle and can reach supersonic velocities there. And in this case, you have a well-known rumble instabilities, known since the work of Bousset et al. In 84, where in a similar way, sound wave perturbing the combustion produce entropy perturbation, and those pockets of gas which are not properly burnt escape through the nozzle. And here again, this nozzle plays the same role as is responsible for some gradients in the flow, and this produces a feedback, and you have this rumble instability, which is a low frequency instability. And another instability in Ariane 5 is similar to that one. So the two physical processes responsible for these instabilities are these two processes here. The first one is related to entropy being carried in a region which is hotter, which with a higher thermal energy. So in this case, you can make a very simple one-dimensional energy argument showing that an entropy perturbation carried into a hotter region is going to have its entropy conserved if the flow is adiabatic, but its energy is going to change by this amount, simply related to the difference of enthalpy between the final state and the initial state. And this change of energy is carried away by acoustic waves. So in this case, you have a very simple description of the advective acoustic coupling, which is really an entropic acoustic coupling. That's why I called it, in this case, an entropic acoustic cycle, if ever you manage to close the cycle on this side by having a shock or whatever. And a quite different process is related to the advection of vorticity rather than entropy. So you can think of this one happening in an isothermal flow, in which case entropy perturbation play no role at all. And in this case, if you try to think of a vorticity perturbation in a flow which is stationary and settling down like at the surface of a neutron star, and if you superimpose a vorticity perturbation onto this kind of hydrostatic atmosphere, the vorticity perturbation is going to lift up some high pressure, some dense and high pressure region, and push down some low pressure region, and this must produce, there is no other way around, this must produce some pressure perturbation, and pressure perturbation won't stay here, they will just propagate. So there is no way to have a silent advection of a vortex in an inhomogeneous medium. So here, this inhomogeneous medium can be the nozzle of the kettle, or the nozzle of the ramjet, or whatever. But as long as you have some gradient in the flow, some gradient of velocity, this mechanism will couple vorticity perturbations to acoustic waves. So to describe this kind of instability, I have introduced, and I'm surprised that nobody did it before in all these different systems, but I have introduced what I call a formalism, but it's not much more than simply four parameters which describe the time scale tau of the cycles and the efficiency of the cycles. And you should see that there are two cycles, one which I call Q and the other I call it R. So there is a purely acoustic cycle. Now I'm going to concentrate on advective acoustic instabilities in which there is a shock and a region of coupling due to some acceleration, deceleration, whatever. Some acoustic wave which propagates up to the shock produces both a reflected acoustic wave and some advective perturbation, vorticity and entropy, both. And an acoustic wave which propagates in a region of gradient will be partially reflected and partially transmitted. And an advected perturbation which reaches, which goes through this region of gradient, produces both a feedback and an acoustic wave propagating out. So this acoustic wave propagating out is the whistle of the kettle, if you wish. And but you really have superimposed two cycles. In what I showed before, I did not emphasize this purely acoustic cycle, which most of the time is negligible, but it's important to take it into account in order to simplify the mathematics of the... Actually, this purely acoustic cycle makes the mathematics more complicated, but it is responsible for a lot of complexity of the system, and if you want to get rid of this complexity, you have to take it into account. So, summarized on this core collapse picture, you have entropy perturbation, acoustic waves producing vorticity, which produce again acoustic waves in a cycle, but those same acoustic waves also produce purely acoustic waves in a cycle. So there are really two cycles with two very different time scales, because this one is dominated by this slow advection of vortices. And so this time scale here is much slower than this time scale here. Here we have an acoustic time scale. Much slower, depending on, of course, on the Mach number. So I can't resist having a short summary of what's happening, of the consequences of what's happening in the core collapse problem, where you have this stalled shock, 150 kilometers above the neutrino sphere, just a few hundred of milliseconds of, after the bounce, and you have this strong cooling region above the neutrino sphere, and some heating region here, and this shock is stalled for a long enough time so that this cycle can take place and give rise to a non-axisymmetric instability of the shock, which has been observed in the numerical simulations of John Blondin in 2003 and by many subsequent studies. And I briefly list this beautiful list of potential consequences of these instabilities. It's remarkable.
Can I ask a question? A question.
It's remarkable, maybe later.
Yeah.
It's remarkable that 5 years ago, none of these consequences were even possible to imagine. Like the problem of a neutron star kick, which is influenced by this aspherical explosion. A new mechanism for core collapse explosions due to acoustic waves, which is initiated by this SASI instability, the asymmetry of this instability is also has some big consequences on the subsequent instabilities in the ejecta. On the mixing of hydrogen and helium in 87A. The spin of the neutron star seems also to be influenced by, in this very recent paper by Blondin, seems to be influenced by some spiral mode of this instability. And last week in Aspen, we heard from Thomas Janka that this instability is also responsible for pushing the shock further out and letting the material being heated long enough by neutrinos, so that an explosion was observed in the simulations of a 15 solar mass progenitor. So those are very exciting consequences, and I wish the situation were as nice for type 1s, but I really doubt it. I should say that this approach of identifying the cycle efficiencies Q and R was really necessary in the case of core collapse because the mechanism behind this beautiful results was really uncertain, and even people like Blondin and Mezzacapa doubted that it was some advective acoustic mechanism and and advocated some purely acoustic mechanism, and it's by measuring these efficiencies Q and R, especially the fact that the purely acoustic cycle is stable with an efficiency smaller than one and the advective acoustic cycle is unstable, that I could show that it is really this instability is really a consequence of the advective acoustic mechanism. So enough of core collapse. Gaining some understanding about this instability is made easier using a very simple toy model, which really looks like a simplified description of a detonation, where you have a shock, a more or less adiabatic region, which you can think of as the induction zone behind the shock, and a region of coupling, which can be either a region of cooling in the case of core collapse, or a region of heat release in the case of detonations, or whatever, an external potential, or whatever process which creates gradients in the flow and which couple advective and acoustic perturbations. This kind of toy model is very useful, in particular, to show the importance of the size of this region of coupling, or more than the size, the time spent inside this region of coupling. So the time it takes for a perturbation to be advected from here to here. So to be advected, for example, from the beginning of the region of heat release to the end of the region of heat release. And this advection time here is responsible for a cutoff in frequency, because, and you can, it's intuitive, you can think that a very high frequency perturbation will not see the gradients of this region, whereas a low frequency perturbation will see this these gradients as a discontinuity. So it's intuitive. If high frequency perturbations are not coupled, so the cycle is destroyed for high frequency perturbation with this cutoff frequency related simply to the time it takes to cross this region, and you can make simple estimate of as a function of frequency, you can measure the growth rate in such a simplified system. If this region of coupling is infinitely thin, you have unstable modes up to very high frequencies at any wavelength, whereas if you take a finite width, like one-tenth of this distance, suddenly all the high-frequency modes are stabilized.
Terry, there must be a low-frequency cutoff as well. If you have low-frequency and long wavelengths, they won't see this length scale of your regional coupling.
Yeah. That's not clear to me. No. Maybe there is an optimum wavelength, but it's not. It will not be stable for very low frequencies. The time scale will be long, but I don't think there is a cutoff at low frequency. So this kind of physical approach allows to understand why SASI is a low frequency instability, and at the same time allows to understand part of the literature about flames, about detonations. The early work about detonations was based on what they call a square wave model, where the heat release was instantaneous and infinite, occurring on a very thin region, and it puzzled many researchers that in this case high frequency modes were unstable and it looked unphysical, and some people like the group of Clavin argued strongly against this kind of square wave model as an unphysical one. But if you take into account this kind of physical argument, it's quite natural to introduce a cutoff. Even in a square wave model, you can introduce some cutoff, some physical cutoff related to this time scale. And more recently, even you find in this kind of literature some studies about the importance of the advection time through the region of heat release.
So there would be a short and sharp cutoff.
No.
It's an L.
Short and sharp. Yeah. No, the problem is, all these kind of description is looks very nice in an idealized way, and indeed, if this is short and sharp, you get very clear results. Once you take into account a flow in which the heat release occurs on a long scale, then results are are more difficult to appreciate. So before I finish, I would like to stress or to illustrate this kind of approach as I applied it in the case of Bondi-Hoyle accretion. And this is a case where you have a supersonic black hole or accretor moving in some uniform gas with a stationary accretion shock attached to it. And this flow is as known to be unstable for many years, for 20 years. And so I have explained this instability by this kind of advective acoustic cycle between the shock and the accretor, where you have this cycle of vorticity and acoustic waves. In this case, it may be relevant to the detonation instability from the fact that this is an accelerated flow towards the black hole, whereas core collapse situations correspond to a decelerated flow towards the neutron star. And this flow is accelerated to supersonic velocity. So this red line is the sonic surface through which the matter is flowing and reaches supersonic velocities inside it. So here we really have a transonic flow, as is the Chapman-Jouguet detonation. And in this, the fact that the flow is transonic was no particular problem for this kind of cycle. And from this complicated eigen spectrum showing the growth rate as a function of frequency, we could extract the value of the efficiencies Q and R. And that's what I meant when I said that taking into account the acoustic cycle is responsible for complexity, but can help us to make the flow look simpler, because this complicated oscillations of the eigenfrequencies with respect to frequency have a much smoother shape when you decompose it into these two cycles. Although the acoustic cycle is moderate, well, it's always stable, so it could be neglected at first glance, but it's still responsible for these strong oscillations. So to conclude, I would like to emphasize the fact that detonation instability can be viewed as an advective acoustic cycle between the shock and the region of heat release, and this formalism has never been applied to it, and I will apply to it during my stay here. So I have shown you some preliminary results concerning the size of the region of heat release, but all of these are preliminary work which will be developed further. And I would like to finish by showing this kind of overview of different types of advective acoustic instabilities, depending on whether the coupling is due to some adiabatic process or cooling or heating process. Yes. And whether the flow is decelerated, accelerated, or even transonic, you have different illustrations. And detonation cover these two categories, since some of the overdriven are fully subsonic, and the Chapman-Jouguet are transonic. And I will stop here. Thank you.
Done a lot of work on this vertical acoustical display, but there's one paper with Chang, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name now, that the mode structure changed, and you talk about it being more like a Coppola Pringle instability. Maybe this is something you and I should talk about offline.
I didn't know.
Well, it seemed to that the character of the instability is different from rotation.
Yeah, well, rotation is certainly a very important factor in the case of core collapse supernovae, and I'm working on it insectly, but here I try to focus on type 1As, and I don't know if rotation is relevant for type 1As.
Here to speculate the white dwarfs are rotating at type 1As? Will that change your...
No, it wouldn't. Well, here, so I have talked mainly about what you missed my comments on your work with Gamezzo in 99, and for which we have many questions.
You better wake up.
So for this work of 99, the scales are very I try to show that the instability responsible for these different cellular patterns is based on the same physical mechanism as the one in core collapse. So you have feedback loops between the shock and the region of heat release. And I wouldn't, before speculating on the effect of rotation on such instabilities, I would rather have your comment on why these studies have had so little they are mentioned, often mentioned, but there has been no further inquiry about their consequences in a realistic context. So is it because the flow...
It's more comfortable to not think about complicated
things. I was wondering about that. Now, is it...
I think the serious answer is that all this tends to happen, at least in the Mesodol calculations, are rather low densities with very little matter and rather few observational consequences.
I think the point was clear, and it showed on the previous slide, where you had the length scale, and the carbon burning being centimeters, nobody can resolve that in
calculation.
So if this happens, it's an effective state, in addition to your propagation speed, but that's it. And then if you come to the kilometer scale, then the density is already so low that the time scale, even for a declination to propagate in this material, is getting longer than the expansion. So very little is happening once it's coming to a scale you could possibly resolve in numerical simulation. And so unless you can't resolve these scales in numerical simulation, in a sense they're irrelevant, you have to put them into some kind of subgradient model, some effective speed or so. And that's how it can be done. And the moment you get to 50,000 kilometers, then the time scale for that, for anything propagating on this length scale, it's much longer than the rest happening, the reaction kinetics happening in the supernova. So only in this position, say, burning only to silicon, it might have an effect of some kind. Of people might be
able. But I don't know if you...
It's there. I think I agree with the threshold book case. Yeah. It just doesn't have any observational consequences. The only place it's been mentioned recently is in like the most recent polarization paper we did on 2014. We sort of alluded to the fact that there seems to be still some structure in the very high velocity stuff, and we allude to this, but I don't think we were convinced that it had anything to do with this.
Yeah. What about the structure of Tycho's rim, which after all, you know, might leave an imprint?
Yeah.
There, well, you know, when you look at it, it has a cognitive periodicity to it.
That's a really good point. I
don't know whether that length scale is related to any of this, but there's something, you know, there is kind of a scale to the fluffiness.
Isn't this scale explained? What is the current understanding of this?
I think that's unexplained at this point.
People just look at it.
Yes, lovely.
They say, look at that.
It's beautiful.
But whether it's coupled to something earlier or something hydrodynamic that's later, I don't know.
But 1006 shows much the same thing. So there, I think that Brock was physics in there somewhere.
But the scale that you get getting back the rotation is presumably rotation will affect the scale depending whether or not you're at the poles or at the equator. I think that's what Wolfgang is talking about.
Well, that was for deflectation. Right. I was discussing that for the deflectation case, that in a deflectating, rotating white dwarf, the radiative tail cannot grow along the equator, but only along the pole
there were suppressed radio data. That was, but in the detonation, in principle, it could go. It wouldn't matter. Well, you still would have some faster expansion on the pole.
But would the scale of your cellular scale, and for example, in Tycho, if that's related to the explosion, have a, if there was rotation involved, be different? Have an azimuthal size?
I would put this question back to Terry, because he's the one that thought about rotation in the context of this instability.
Well, in the context of that one,
answer it today. Given that in the core collapse problem, rotation seemed to make even a qualitative difference.
Yeah.
The question of how much rotation might change the detonation cell structure.
Well, I haven't answered the question in the core collapse case. I have some hints because I have some clear ideas about the geometry, about whether it's a spherical, well, it is a spherical shock, more or less, and I know where the cooling occurs close to the neutron star. In this case, if the detonation is, it depends on where the detonation is initiated, if it's propagating radially or azimuthally, it's the picture is much less clear to me. So I don't have much to say about rotation.
I have a question to Greg. So why is the scale between, say, carbon burning and oxygen burning so different? If carbon burning is centimeters and then oxygen would be kilometers, so why is that? But the Q value between these two is not so
at a given density and temperature, it's just the nuclear burning time scale.
Yeah, it's this part actually. Yeah.
But it's not so different from carbon and oxygen. Silicon, I have then thought.
Silicon is certainly slower.
No, but the Q value is lower. If you calculate your Mach number, then it's Q and enters, and it is then, of course, small for silicon. Therefore, the Mach number gets lower, the heating gets lower, and so on.
I confess I'd have to go back and to remind myself.
I was just curious.
Sure.
There's a factor of 10 to 5 difference between carbon and oxygen.
Besides, it came out of simulations, which it did. I think the carbon burning is faster.
Yeah, that's for sure. But the factor of 10 to the 5,
yeah, that is
it looks a bit. But,
it's another factor, 10 to the 5
so.
But yeah, you would think
silicon
burning would be more slow than the oxygen.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Yeah. Well, the difference
is a quantity. Yeah, here actually, it would be 10 to the 3 here, because here it says 100 centimeters. This is 1 meter.
Yeah.
I wrote centimeter, but it's really 1 meter.
Yeah.
And here it's 10 to the 5.
Okay.
That's 100.
I'm also pretty sure that it's the right job and did everything right. I was just curious about the number that I couldn't read. But just,
okay, thank you.
I have a small technical announcement for those of you who were on the